The Simpaholics. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me is
Aaron O'Brien.
And we got a guest with us again this week. We've got Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek.
Welcome, sir.
Oh, cool. A guest. Oh, wait, that's me? Okay.
Yes, sir.
So, Larry's been on the show three times, so this will make the fourth time you've been on the show so far. So, welcome again.
Who's counting?
we always have, when Larry is on, he has probably the most insightful information and lore about Star Trek that anybody usually ever has. I mean, his ideas of, well, not just ideas, but his knowledge behind the scenes stuff is pretty damn cool.
Oh, well, until tonight. And tonight I'm just going to fail you. So everybody just stop listening right now.
No, I'm kidding. Unsubscribe from Synthology.
Everyone go home.
It's hopeless. So, yeah. This is actually the Prime adjacent universe. So we're a little off here tonight.
Oh,
so,
no. Yes.
Prime 0.1.
Yeah, whatever it gets called now.
Well, so Larry. Yeah.
But thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We love having you on.
Interesting time in Trek land right now.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We want to get all your ideas and takes on all this, but you have a pretty good announcement, big announcement coming up about your new podcast.
Well, yeah, it's actually started, but that's no big deal. It's been out for 5 weeks.
We announced it back when you sent us that press release. Yeah.
Yes. Cool. Thank you guys for doing that too. So the Trek Files is basically Rod Roddenberry's idea to get into some more of his dad's papers and letters and files and memos and things, but put them out there instead of just like printing, you know, documents you could download, which they have been doing over the years or so, to talk about them, put them in context for people, and you know, like everything old is new again, kind of a perspective. And if you're a veteran fan, it will make sense to you. And even if you're, you know, I'm so fascinated. I've said on Trekland Tuesdays Live and other places that my big goal this year is to really meet and talk to fans who have just become Trek fans with Discovery. I really want to, and even the Kelvin movies. I really want to talk to them. And if they stuck around long enough to make them call themselves Trek fans now, and if they want to start going back to, you know, the earlier shows, that's cool. And if they don't, that's cool too. I just want to talk to them because I know the world that I came to, which was I didn't see Mantrap in 1966, but I was the second wave of, you know, I was a rerun baby in the 70s.
Right.
And then I've seen everybody come into things. And it's one thing to talk about, you know, all the controversies of Discovery and go, oh, you know, they were mad about Enterprise and they were mad about DS9 and they were mad about the Wrath of Khan and people were mad about the third season of the original series back then. So, you know, it's like there's always been that, and then things kind of like settle down into the great material continuum. Everything kind of calms down eventually.
Coalesces.
And assimilated, yeah. They all get assimilated, to coin a phrase. So, but these people that all the fans that are really gung-ho now and they're new and fresh, and of course if they're that young, they're probably, you know, social media generation and all that, and just – but both about their attitudes about the show and Star Trek and what they see. And also I want to talk to them about, you know, at times old fandom has not been kind to them.
I agree with that, Larry. That's been very evident. Not everybody. I don't want to say that everybody has, but I've seen that more than once.
I still think it's just the loud 10-15%. And you know what? There are people I have legitimate criticisms of. And I say legitimate. I mean, I have criticisms. Mm-hmm. I say legitimate criticism like legitimate criticism as a thing for like, critiquing movies or literature or anything that you're
sure,
that there's criticism
sure,
of
sure,
legitimate
sure. As do we,
as versus like just, you know, and if you're saying I'm just sentimentally attached, Yeah. If you're saying I'm just sentimentally, emotionally attached to this and I can't see the bridge to there and I'm unhappy, that's fine too. A lot of original series people never watched the Next Generation. I mean, they didn't come along like in a year or two. A lot of people never came back to canon's, you know, filming Star Trek after the Next original series era people.
Right.
Never did.
Right.
Oddly enough, I think I heard from a lot of them who came back for Enterprise because they thought it would tie into – I mean, I know that sounds weird in a way with all the hoopla that Enterprise took.
Yeah, it does, but that's interesting.
It did tie in better because we got Andorians. I mean, we got a lot of Shran, and we got some Orions. I mean, we got Tellarites too. We got some classic Star Trek aliens that we never got in any of the other series.
Yeah.
So it kind of did tie back to the original series a little bit better than any of the other series.
Right.
The same production team, or pretty much the same production team, was producing it as Next Gen DS9 Voyager, but on screen it was supposedly tying into the Kirk era. So that's what people went with, not like who was making it. So that part of it, on one hand, somebody watching the franchise, that was a disconnect. But on the other hand, as a fan, just watching things on my screen, I could totally get that. But I think that's still a shock to a lot of mainstream fandom. Back in the day it was. But I heard from a lot of people back then that said, you know. So my point here is I want to hear their perspective on what they like about the show. And as a fresh face, as they're not weighed down by baggage, good and bad, from before shows. And also they're not weighed down by baggage of the past fandom unless they've actually crossed swords. And it's something about – do they have this – and I say they, like it's all one big box, which it isn't. But do some of the newer fans that have come in with Discovery, have they got a perception of what quote-unquote old Star Trek fandom is like and they want no part of it? Or have they seen good and bad and has any of it been depressing?
Right.
Does it send them running back into their Discovery cave and they just find their other five new friends and they all watch and they don't really want to go to it? You know, I'm just really curious because I catch myself doing this. I catch myself on my Tuesday Live 15-minute thing on Facebook, which is not the Trek Files. Trek Files is pretty set and it's pretty there, and I hope everybody's listening to it. It's just 15 minutes a week. I have a guest. We pull out a doc. The doc is on the Facebook page, and then people can comment there. And I've had Dave Rossi has been a guest and will be a guest in the future, and Dorothy Fontana has been a guest.
That's awesome.
And she was on this last one. We actually got out. They're not always – I mean, we made news because I knew we would when we found this lost proposal for an 1986 version of The Next Generation before they got Gene on board. In fact, it actually kind of poked him to get on board finally.
Cool.
That was truly news because I fell off my chair when I saw it. We were going to the paper. There's other things that we do that are not secret. They've been out there for ages. A lot of fans may not be familiar with them, and they ought to be. But like Gene's original pitch in 64 and an original series writer's guide, and we've talked about those. And Dorothy's first show was we went back to, I think she said, I said, did you type this? And she said, I may have. Let's get it down to the level, guys. She, the original, the Captain April at USS Yorktown, the crew is 203. Spock is a lieutenant in the bridge. And number one is this, first, all of that Pike era, the original concept of the show. We talked about that with Dorothy and went back to some of the, the major points that, again, for history's sake is cool, but also like here's a foundational stone of Star Trek. Anything that's got Star Trek written on it, no matter who's doing it, ought to hit these points.
Yeah.
Right. Or else it's not Star Trek, and why would anybody care? And why would it's one thing to go, I'm not fathoming it, because it's like, well, that's your individual thing. But in the bigger picture, if you have 20 or 30 million people all saying that, then somebody went wrong somewhere.
Well, it's interesting for a couple points that you made. I mean, before you were talking about younger fans, which is interesting because I've been, and me and Dave.
That's my goal for the year.
Yeah, me and Dave talked about this more than once, that we as older fans need to foster the newer fans. If we become gatekeepers and they are not allowed inside our fan club, we've lost the next generation of Star Trek fans. And then when we pass on, that's it.
And
I
want to meet these people. I don't think I've met anybody yet who's only a disco Star Trek person.
Well,
Larry, if you meet anyone that's just a Star Trek disco person, let me know. I'd love to come talk with you with them because I want to know what that's like.
I, I find the only issue with that.
It's like no one we've ever met before. No.
The only issue is that because with CBS All Access, unless you have another incentive or your uncle or your dad or somebody is signed up for it, you probably aren't signing up on your own.
Well, that's the thing. Like, how many new people did Star Trek Discovery actually reach?
That's what I'm worried about in the North American segment of popular. Everywhere else in the world, people can just Netflix
Or in Canada, they can just watch it on TV.
Yeah, yeah, right. So
like old school.
Yeah, so I think that's the only issue I can see. I hope that All Access or releases like the first season sooner or later to Netflix so everyone can see it. Because I think
I don't think they're going to. I think that's too much incentive for people to come
to
All Access.
I mean, how the hell do I know? But
honestly, I'm surprised they haven't pulled all of Star Trek from Netflix and just put it on All Access. You know what I mean? To force people into it who want it.
That would be – I mean, what Larry's talking about right now would be disastrous for getting new fans. I mean, unless you have another reason to go onto All Access, or it's very difficult to get more people onto it.
Since Netflix funded the first season of Discovery, I don't think CBS can pull Star Trek from Netflix.
I'm sure.
Because of that deal.
Well, we're talking about couple of different things here, and Americans listeners will get confused. When we're saying they've got the deal with Netflix and they can't pull it, we're talking about everywhere but the U.S. Like, I think it's 185, 186 countries.
Yeah.
Well, they actually did a press release and said they have 188 countries, and it's all but two of them, U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
That's right. Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're talking about not pulling it from that country. And
I was talking about pulling TOS, Enterprise, Next Gen.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
From Netflix everywhere and putting it only on All Access. Right. You know what I mean? Just so Trekkies had to go there for it. But I don't think they can.
Until Access is bigger, that would be cutting off the nose to spite the face.
I agree. I mean, that's a possibility. I could see somebody doing some stupid thing, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, I don't think they can because of the deal that they made with Netflix and showing Discovery. If they pulled all the other Star Treks, that'd be like stabbing Netflix in the back.
Right.
Globally. So but I don't think it makes sense either because if you're trying to feed the new pipeline – the way in from the back end. And if you've got a – I don't know. See, this is the thing. It's like Next Gen Start. I used to call them the loud 10%. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't watch, you know? But then I was talking about the original series people who went away for Next Gen. Mm-hmm. But then Next Gen kind of like had the last laugh because the numbers for Next Generation wound up being, you know, dwarfing the numbers even of the rerun generation at the time of the movies.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it wound up having, you know, viewer numbers. And then when they started doing the local, you know, 5 days a week local syndication stripping,
right,
like 5 or 6 years into Next Generation,
right,
the numbers of those things were dwarfing what they were, which is why original series, you know, like the actor's status, you quit seeing the original series actors. It was all Next Gen and the Foam and the spinoff series. And the original series were kind of like, guys were kind of like, I don't want to say they were a dime a dozen, but it was hard to see them at conventions until what's his name? It's Slanted Fedora started doing the Fab Four tour in the early, in the early aughts or so. And then he kind of brought – it was almost like for 5 or 6 years they went away and then he brought them back and made it – you know, but then by the time DS9 and Voyager were on and the fan base was splitting and all the other sci-fi was coming to TV and this monster that Next Gen helped create was starting to eat Star Trek a little bit.
Yeah.
And the numbers were going down and it was getting tired and Enterprise made people mad, sadly, whatever. And then it went off in 2005 and you wondered and people were saying, oh, the suits who were on, you know, Main Street Hollywood were thinking, oh, this Star Trek has to go away for 10 or 20 years and recoup, you know, before JJ jumped in to do a movie and shocked people, which I thought that was stupid. I don't think it was fan fatigue. I think it was producer fatigue on Enterprise.
Yeah, but, yeah. Because the fans were all there.
The fan film movies were starting to boom. But that's when the pendulum – I talk about, you know, the pendulum swings and what goes in and out of style. And there for a while, the original series was laughed at, you know, the plywood and Christmas lights. But then pretty soon, within 5 or 6 years, it's, oh, Next Generation, it's so 80s, it's a therapist on the bridge and carpet on the walls and la-di-da, and the 60s is so retro cool and, you know, and it swung back. And that's why the JJ movies, their idea was, you know, we have to go back to the roots to get people back to see Star Trek, which had a point, but it's like we're going to have alternate routes. But anyway,
right. I do think that JJ movies brought a lot of people on. I think we could have a lot of younger fans if Discovery is released to the wide audience, maybe after, you know, like they do in like Walking Dead after I don't know how many.
It's like right before the new season comes out, they throw it on.
They'll throw it Netflix on Netflix so you can catch up. I think that would be ingenious if they did that or something like that.
I hope they do that with Discovery. I just don't think they will.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they'll run some kind of marathon, but you have to be streaming. Maybe they'll do it on CBS, but maybe they'll do it on some off thing that's not their prime expensive CBS airtime.
I don't know.
But the thing is,
maybe they'll do it on Showtime.
same thing, but yeah. But see, when we talk about the newer fans, and I even hate to say the younger fans, because I'd like to – that's another thing. I'd like to know the demographics of who's fresh and coming. And I do this every week on Trekland Tuesdays Live. A guy a few months ago in October, one of my fans on one of my pages, put me on to Parrot Analytics, which is now has suddenly – and I've been talking about them for months. And now suddenly Forbes did a story and it went big, and then somebody else did one recently. But they have a thing called average demand expression. So all Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, all the streamers don't have, you know, audience ratings like all the broadcasts have always had since the 50s, since the beginning, to set ad rates by, because it's a whole different business model. So no one knew like numbers and what was – you get an idea when you see people talking of what's most popular. Mm-hmm. You know, and what's not, but there's so much peak TV, and there's so many programs out there. And these guys 7 years ago in Australia, and they came to the States maybe 4 years ago, and I didn't know about them until it crossed Discovery's orbit, and so these Parrot Analytics guys have what they call average demand expressions, and they basically measure the entire internet and beyond for people talking about something, and they measure that.
Okay.
And if you have actual viewer numbers, they do that. But they measure the digitals only, the digital origination, you know, only. And then they measure everything. So like the premium channel, like Game of Thrones is HBO, which it's not broadcast, but it's not, you know, totally digital. And they measure the digitals only, and then they measure like they do all. But they publish every week. They publish a top 10 on both sides. And they've been doing it for a while. And when Discovery came out, it immediately went to like number one or number two every week on the digitals.
Wow.
And sometimes it's usually in the top four. Like at the peak of everybody having fresh shows out, which is when everybody's at their highest, the mix shows would be, you know, Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, Star Trek, and then Stranger Things this last year.
Right.
And then on the digital side, it would either be Discovery, Stranger Things, or Stranger Things, Discovery. Mm-hmm. And maybe Discovery number three. And then since Discovery was number one right before the hiatus, and then since the hiatus, in their metric, Discovery's been number one, and it keeps gaining. And of course, it was they kept breaking their own record. And not only that, but I guess most of the other shows aren't putting out fresh stuff right now, fresh episodes.
It's interesting. It's very.
And there was a big gap. That's one way to look at it. So that's why when CBS talks about they're in this, you know, enigma, how they love their numbers and it's been a huge hit, and they renewed Discovery for a second season real fast. But the world is kind of going, okay, but we don't see any numbers. Well, none of them put their numbers out. But this is at least kind of an apples to apples, you know, it's at least one measuring stick, and here's how they're doing. And then Moonved said actual numbers. He said they had about 5 million subscribers for Showtime and All Access now, about 50-50. But I think he'd said they had about 2 million All Access before Discovery
came out.
Before it came out. Yeah, I remember.
But the bottom line still is, how many of those, back to what we're saying
Do you think,
how many are brand new people and how many are old fans taking it?
Do you think that when they – I'm sorry.
I just said what real quick. So the bottom of the thing I was trying to get to the whole time, then I'll shut up. The thing I was trying to get to, I'm sitting here, you're sitting here, we're all talking about, we want to meet newer fans, meaning they came to Discovery from nothing else in Trek, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Which is going to be, they're going to just be age-wise very younger with few exceptions.
Sure.
The thing is, we talk about, like I go to conventions, I do my show of hands, and it's always original series, next gen, and then a few a few DS9 Voyager Enterprise people. Mm-hmm. The point is, like, we're traveling in different worlds.
Right.
Even right. online. Because they're all, I don't know, I don't want to be, you know, gripey old man with kids on the lawn, but like, are they all Snapchatting? I mean, like, I don't know how many overlapping paths. Facebook is so old people's game now. Mm-hmm. If you don't catch in Twitter or Instagram, if they're social, you know, whatever. But I think we're sitting here going, who are they? I'm on a quest. I don't want to sound stupid. Right. But I know that some of the normal paths, we're not going to catch them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I'm sure they got people working on this in some, mm-hmm. some lab somewhere, but, I was going to make the point. Other Labs. Point I was going to make. Yeah, I was going to make a point earlier. Is that do you think when they release their annual like report of you know how much money yeah. they made profit report? Do you think they'll give any numbers for CBS All Access when that's released?
They might, but see, like if they're doing like Netflix and all those guys, they're very guarded about that because okay. they're one up. Now I did see where Nielsen's. When I first started talking about this, like in October on the Trekland Tuesdays, mm-hmm. the first week or two, I also saw a news story that said, now think about this a minute. If Nielsen's, who's been measuring the rating, you know, we talk about the Nielsen's since, you know, the 60s with Star Trek and all the way back to the beginning of time and TV. Mm-hmm. If broadcast TV does become a dinosaur and everybody's got cable or they're streaming or whatever they do, if, you know, data's right – TV goes away by 2040, but or whatever. But if TV's away, Nielsen's is going to be like, you know, the blacksmith horseshoer guy or the telegrapher. You know,
he'll
be out of a job if broadcast TV goes away. So they're like trying to get streaming. Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. They're trying to get. And there was a story where they were doing a deal with Netflix to start releasing. Some kind of limited numbers, but like they want to be the guide for streaming too.
Yeah,
but streaming is still like enjoying being the new kid on the block with the new way of doing things. So it's like Nielsen's wants to survive. They're looking down the road too. So anyway, it's all interesting, and everybody's like adjusting. And it's been one of the things these last few months has been watching people that I know watch Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. and I know like they watch even Walking Dead, which is still on it. It's not even on a premium. Walking AMC is still
AMC,
on.
AMC, right? Yeah, yeah, right.
But whatever it is, if they're heavily serialized, and the whole way they do that of the short seasons with all these new shows. But Star Trek fans, all they know is, you know, what they knew from 2005 before
episodic, yeah,
episodic and long seasons and standalones and all that. And they know what's been going on. They watch these shows, but the minute they start watching their Star Trek. They don't bring their modern TV, peak TV, you know, cinematic TV filter with them. And they're watching it with their 15-year-old glasses and complaining.
Right, right.
Or at least knowing this is going to happen. I mean, I tried to intellectually know this was happening. And it still is a big adjustment, even when you're expecting it.
Right, right.
Ironically, even though they were going for this big, long arc in Discovery, it still kind of felt episodic to me. Because you got a tardigrade episode, you got a Harry Mudd episode, you got a Sarek episode. Mm, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like my contention about Discovery is I felt like it was pitched wrong. They said it was a Klingon War series, and I'm like, no, this is a Lorca getting back to the Mirror Universe series, bookended by Klingon War.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not the same thing as being.
But
about
if they'd
Klingon
said
War.
That, it would have given away the
beat. Right.
Or they could have just said this is a story that is set with the backdrop of the Klingon War. That way, they can say this is not the main story. That'll just make us speculate.
Well,
more.
I made the joke last episode. It's like Casablanca takes place during the war, but it's a love story. It's just the war is the backdrop.
They could have mm-hmm. told us the truth without giving everything away.
Right. Well, Larry, since we're on the subject, and I do want to know so much your inner thinkings of Discovery. I mean, I know that. We all like me and Dave. We love Discovery, but we do think there were things that they could have done a little better.
And we praise the good, and we call out when we didn't.
And there were some beautiful moments. It's a beautiful show. Acting's wonderful. I think the writing. Sometimes I think they wrote themselves into a corner where they could have maybe planned it out better.
I think part of that is the Brian Fuller departure. He gave them three episodes, and then they just kind of had to figure it out from there.
But what is like? Let's hear your thoughts, because this Larry's thoughts. You're the man of the hour, and we really do want to know what you think about this, because Discovery
can't handle the pressure.
Discovery is an important show, especially for us Trek fans, because it makes or breaks the viability of Trek now here and for the next.
However long it lasts.
Yeah. 10 years, 5 years, I don't know.
Well, that's true, and it's a viability factor for existing fandom, and we were talking about new. I mean, like, I don't want to underestimate this, but I had a sense a couple years ago that I wanted to start, even before Discovery, I really wanted to sit down and start finding, and I didn't really get to do it, but around the 50th anniversary, we're all so busy there for a year. It's like we went from celebrating the 50th into all the lathering up about Discovery.
Right, yeah.
And somewhere in there, it was starting to dawn on me that we were overlooking the Kelvin, the JJ-verse people who were coming in, and in all the in all the hoo-ha about people debating it in existing fandom, like no one was listening to the people. Occasionally I would hear from people at cons, and in panels and things, or they'd come by my table at a convention or something, or occasionally would pop up in a Twitter conversation or something. But I really wanted to hear the people that came to Trek, because there are a lot of them, and a lot of them did go back. And I used to say that in 2010, the most reassuring thing was the thing I tried to turn into a line and say that the JJ movies are the best gateway drug Star Trek ever had.
Right.
Absolutely.
The biggest budget gateway drug anyway.
Except for those people who got the gateway drug, came in, and then all the old fogies just yelled at them for liking the Kelvin movies. And I'm just like, the beautiful thing about the Kelvin movies is that they've specifically said they're in a different timeline.
Yeah.
There's nothing to hate other than the fact that
it's a different timeline.
Other than you may not like the story.
Right.
I was a little frustrated in that I wish we weren't spending 10 years. I knew they would eventually run their course, like after 3 and maybe 4, that no one, like those actors would not want to, if it was really that cast in that format, that that those actors wouldn't want to keep playing those roles after 3 or 4 movies, and that pendulum would swing back the other way, and something would be different. Okay. But for right then, since they and I did not want them to bomb, because if they had bombed, that would have been bad for the whole Star Trek brand.
Right.
No matter
what. Absolutely.
Yeah, you need to go. And I thought the strongest things about them were that they were well cast. Mm-hmm. And that they brought so many new people in.
And they look fantastic.
And they were fun.
And they do look fantastic, and they're fun, yeah. I was just frustrated because I didn't think they added anything to the bigger Star Trek universe.
Right, and my thing is it made it into an action schlock compared to
Like, oh, we've wasted these 10 years. Time has been ticking by in my life. I could have seen fresh Trek. And I talk all the time about Trek, but, when Discovery – it was a change of gears a little bit, but I talk about, we've had 12, I talk about the fallow years, and we've had 12 years in the wandering in the desert, which is why I thought the opening scene of the pilot on Discovery was them wandering in the desert.
Yeah,
I wonder if this is...
That's poetic.
Yeah, we're coming in from the desert here.
For 40 years.
About this.
Yeah, wandering in 40 years like Moses. And but let's get back on Discovery. Like, what do you – like, when you watched it – now, we're completely we're through the first season. We've digested it. What do you feel about this? What was the high points? What's the low points? What were you conflicted with?
So all the way through, I always try to think out of the box on things, and I get the idea that this was going to be a twisty turny. I think I was even surprised on that, like the reveals and the surprise and the twist. But the first thing before we talk about anything is, yes, what you started to say. Remember that it started as Brian's show. They took his arc and basically went with it and finished it up basically the way they wanted to. But like the day to day meat to detail. Was obviously not going to have his polish, his patina on it, but the bones of the show was what he laid out, and then they probably felt 50-50 at least or something. But where the devil in the details is Brian's here. He hires a staff. He leaves. They don't kick out his staff, his writing staff. They don't say, you were a Brian guy, you're out of here. So Joe Manosky and all those names you see in there, they, for at least one or two or three episodes, are around. But the whole show took so long to launch because of the delay, all that, you know, craziness at the beginning until Brian left. And then they're scrambling to get going. They hired new people one by one. And so for a chunk of the show, they had like overlapping generations of writers who were coming in from different times. And bit by bit, all of the Brian era people went on to other things.
Okay.
Right. Nobody was like let go. They all left when they wanted to. But some of them had been on contract for like a year and they couldn't be renewed for another whole year. They just wanted to see their show done and right. they had to go. Right. Or they one of them sold a pilot and went off and did his own show. So it's like the new group came in and we're in the middle of this transition. So it's almost like it was like a fourth Brian setup, a fourth was the overlapping casts, and only the last half was like really the show the existing writers were writing, and the ones that are sitting down to do season two are getting to start with a clean slate. They were inheriting all those sets and costumes and basic, you know, Klingon thrust at the beginning.
Right. Yeah, I noticed and that then, some of those writers were like CBS, like in-house writers, so they were like they work for CBS, you know, for different shows too.
Yeah.
They don't just do, you know, whatever it is, if it's NCIS or whatever, they write for those or whatever the ones they wrote for. So,
well, I mean, it's not like workers outside of Home Depot that they show up every morning and they say, oh, you want to come work on.
That'd be interesting.
But almost.
But it'd be interesting if it was, because that would be really wild.
Yeah. I mean, in the old days, like the Desilu days, the 60s, that's like crew people would be that way. You'd go to Desilu and I've talked to people that said one day they'd work on Lucy, one day they'd work on Star Trek, one day they'd work on Mission Impossible on stage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Batman.
Like rips and gaffers. But not the writers. They do have a contract for one show at a time unless somehow they're getting to work on two at a time. But it's not quite that random.
Right.
But that's the thing of – I know, you know, if my friend that knows me has a contract and he has two or three shows right now at the same place and I go one year I'm on one show and one year on another one because that's they're gearing up or they need or they had a gap and I'd really want to work on this and more than that one, but that was a paycheck for a while and I liked it, but now I'm really getting to do one. That kind of a thing. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that happens. But my bottom line here is the show, as we watched it unroll, it's kind of like that dancing as fast as I can,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying – the amazing thing to me is if this had been any other thing, if this had been any other property, if this was not launching a new business, you know, paradigm, if this wasn't launching All Access, this wasn't just a new show. It was a new Star Trek, and it was a new Star Trek that a whole business division
was being
platform was pinned to.
Yeah, right? I make the joke that this All Access was basically lifted on the backs of Star Trek fans.
Right, just like UPN was trying to launch with Voyager.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
that
right.
was all that. And you don't blame them for doing that. But my point is, if this had been anything else, this is just another show. The way it started off, they would have pulled the plug and said, okay, too many problems. This is just too troubled. Let's all just like cut our losses, quit spending money. Let's just, but because it was Star Trek and the whole world was watching, and because this whole new corporate, you know, flowchart box was going to depend on it, and they could not, like, you must land this plane. And that's what, you know, Aaron and Gretchen did, and you know, with Alex there. And everything. I mean, they landed the plane pretty well. You know, now, if we want to go back and look at the hiccups and talk about it, we can and we should. But just bear in mind that a lot of things at the end weren't – the things at the beginning may not have been the choices of those who
those
ended up.
Those people who started it. Yeah.
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what makes me so excited about season two. As long as there's no major shakeup, season two should be amazing.
Yes.
I just hope that they keep it and don't shake things up, because if they do another shakeup, I don't want another rough season.
Well,
you know?
We'll know. Well, that's CBS. I mean, for one thing, shakeups and chaos is expensive.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
When you can do a clear thing and not have to have hiccups along the way or whatever,
right?
It's going to be cheaper,
right?
And just not having like a crew coming in and having to work overtime on a weekend or something to build a set or to do something is a lot cheaper than
right.
having a well the old like used to call the Berman era, you know, after third season Next Gen to the end, aside from some hiccups on Voyager at times, but it was like the well-oiled machine. was just cranking Star Trek out and doing movies on the side there for, you know, 15 years.
I really hope we get,
that's what they want to get back to.
Yeah.
I hope so. I really hope we get Ronald D. Moore as at least a guest writer for one episode next season. Like, if he can't do anything else. I know he's busy with other stuff, but I'd love to see.
He's got Outlander and, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why Brian was in the beginning. He was like, if they wanted to get an old Trek veteran, it's like, excuse me, a veteran, not old. Like, who's open? Who's not contracted away to something?
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them were. A lot of them were tied up.
Yeah.
I know one that wanted to. I know one who has a good gig, who actually asked his boss if there was a new Star Trek show announced, if he could get an out from his contract to go work on it.
Hmm.
Just internally, without asking anybody else, just on his own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they basically laughed at him. So.
Hmm.
You know, it's not like he went over and said, "Let me write for you." And they said, "Okay." He just did it on his own.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Just to see.
It's a shame the way like all the contracts and stuff work out in Hollywood, where they can't like have any flexibility. And I think that was what the most recent strike was about too, was because since shows are a lot shorter now than what they used to be, to get more flexibility with their writing contracts.
Yeah.
Well, with a lot of things connected to those short, you know, they don't make the hours they have to put in on their health insurance and all that kind of stuff is, you know, yes, I worked a whole season on this show, but now it's half as long as it used to be. So.
Right, right. Well, with Discovery as well,
Discovery.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love your general takeaway of this. I mean, I know we're getting into the nuts and bolts of it.
I just wanted to say that up front because everybody jumps in to talk about these things, and we should. I'm not saying we can't because it's on film. It's there. It's going to be there for all time the way it is.
Right.
But it's going to be helpful for us to know what was going on that we see these things through.
Yeah.
But having said all that, I understand the way of creativity and like priorities, and when people have chaos in front of them and different people's shifting priorities and people's definitions of keeping canon, even producers' visions of it and all of this stuff. And people, artistic people who are talented wanting to prove what they can do and all of that. And the fact that it's 2017 and there's so many things and people are out wanting to show off because there's other stuff on TV and they want to put their best foot forward. All of that. And I still, you know, wince at touchscreen consoles and all of yours, just like everybody else. I was like, okay, my headcanon is that they figure out in a couple of years that this is all causing a new kind of cancer and they have to
we gotta shut this off.
Well, I mean, they did go back to view screens for episode 9. We saw Lorca call Admiral Terrell, and they weren't on hologram for some reason.
And then all the time in the mirror universe, she's using using that little console. Like there was a console that had like 4 panels on it, and she's calling Saru on the Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mock ISS Discovery from the flagship.
Why wouldn't you just do audio only? It seems like it'd be a huge data file that someone could easily track if it's a hologram.
Well, the one that was really weird was when the Admiral was talking to Lorca on the bridge and letting everyone see
Their interactions,
yeah. And I'm like, well, wouldn't this have been the kind of I'll take it in the ready room, or I'll put on a secure channel or whatever.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a big deal when, you know, Decker was in command and
he was challenging, or Spock was challenging him.
Kirk was calling him, and they come in, and Decker says, "Down here, like, come down here and talk to him on the speaker so the whole bridge won't hear it."
Right,
kind of a thing.
Yeah,
even
absolutely.
Though they were all going to hear it. But, I mean, that kind of – that privacy thing, like, we would go in the – because then it was the plot point that everybody did hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, wow, if you're calling in and you've got, like, this secret mission or you think there's going to be an argument, do you really want
– everyone to hear
you're
it.
Not going to code it? But, yeah. But they wanted everybody to hear
you,
it.
You can just tell them it's treason if they mention it outside the room. It's cool.
Yeah.
It's a big room, though. That's a big bridge.
It's a big bridge.
But yeah, and it's – and I know a lot of people at the beginning – like darker literally and figuratively, you know, like this is a lot of people watched the first show or two and said, this is not Star Trek. This is way too dark for me. And they're watching Lorca and they're watching even the third episode. They're watching Landry be a real shithead, you know, and, you know, racist, a condescending, you know, treat the prisoners like scum and all that. And it was, you felt like you're watching something that was not Star Trek.
I was hoping she was Mira Landry.
Yeah, yeah, I wondered about that. It seems like she was almost nicer in the mirror than she was.
Exactly, I believe that.
Well, it's a mirror, so the shithead on Prime was nice in the other one. So
that, there you go. At least she didn't have a goatee.
Yeah, that would be weird.
She's the bearded woman at the circus.
And all of, you know, I remember the first season of Next Gen, and we were so thrilled to have a show after 20 years that, like, people were hanging on for everything. And I remember it got a little better at the end of the first season with Conspiracy and the Neutral Zone, and oh, look, the Romulans, and people were so excited and trying to find crumbs of why it was getting better. And I saw a couple of new names in the writing staff. I go, it must be these new writers they have. And, you know, Tracy Torme and the there was a woman. And I was like, it must be them. Like, well, no, they're in the mix, but it's still the same. Right. You know, it's, now we know. It's like the chaos of the first year or two and, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
But you people hung out through that because they were so hungry for new stuff, new Trek, that they hung on. And then the second season was a little better, and then third season was a little crazy, little better, and then they were settling in pretty well. And then Best of Both Worlds happened, and bang, they were off to the races, and the world found out about it and exploded. And you know, the last thing you want Discovery to do is, like, same reason, you don't want it to bomb.
Right.
You don't want all access to bomb, because that would be horrible. Then Star Trek would have a whoever's fault it was, it wouldn't matter. The suits and the bean counters would all go, Star Trek was a failure. We must wait at least 20 years before we try to bring it back again. Right. You know.
Well, and on top of all that, I mean, like we were saying last episode, I think we were talking about, like, even if you watch Game of Thrones, the first season, I mean, not that it was terrible, it's just it wasn't like high production. It wasn't anything that incredible. It was just interesting, and it got captured people's attention. And then the next season was, they upped the ante even more, and they got more and more. So I mean, like, you know, I'm not saying that you're going to capture that kind of fire in the bottle, because that's a totally different animal. But and then
we were saying this before Discovery came out. We were saying Discovery needs to be the strongest first season of Star Trek ever, and it kind of was, but it still wasn't as strong as kind of we were hoping. Right. I think.
Yeah, right, exactly. And
well, it's a whole different – I said it's a whole different landscape. And what I was just saying about it, it's almost like there were three mini eras, like the Brian era from the pilot, although he was gone before they finished writing that. The newer people, the mid-level people coming on staff, were still there in time to have input on the pilot script, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like October and November before they started shooting in January, they were still there in time to have some input on the script. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like those three eras, we were laughing about how 15 episodes, they had to be good coming out of the gate, and how it wasn't like any other Trek. But at the same time, if you measure it in streaming years, it's almost like your little joke about no Star Trek gets good until the third season, except for the original series.
Right.
It's almost like their third season was maybe that last half of the first season. It's like compression.
Right. Yeah. We were saying that forever, is that when Discovery comes out, it's got to hit the ground running so fast to overtake everything, especially with competition that's out there these days. So,
And the competition here wasn't even so much about, I think, award season and critics. But the real competition they were racing against was trying to get people to sign up.
Yeah.
Because it was basically a one show. I mean, unless you just love Kristen Baranski or whatever her name is on The Good Fight.
Right.
At the moment. And they're racing to get other sci-fi on. And the thing that's really intriguing right now is they're basically happy with Star Trek. And the second season will prove that, you know, how much on the scale it they're happy and it's good and better and settled. Mm-hmm. But the real thing is, like, how soon are they thinking about maybe spinning off not just some more getting some more sci-fi on, but another series, and what they will do, and if they'll go back to Brian's original anthology format and do that, or if they will try to have another standing crew show and set it in another era.
Yeah.
And maybe some of the things people have wanted, maybe they'll do a post-Nemesis Star Trek. And a lot of these complaints people have.
That would be really interesting. Well, post Nemesis.
I think it also depends on how much they value the people who are leaving now that Discovery's over. I'd be interested. I mean, we're not going to see them ever, but CBS has got to see an exodus, because I see people on Facebook all the time saying I'm canceling all access now that Discovery's over. But I mean, if they want to keep us, they need to have, like, a, you know, two shows that, like, go in between each other. So you've got like Discovery half the year, and you got another show the other half the year, and you only have a couple months in between where there's no Star Trek.
Yeah, Walking Dead has Walking Dead and Fear of the Walking Dead. I mean, it's like that came later, like whatever, five or six seasons later. But I mean, it is one of those things where if they had more than one show going, and even if they piggybacked off each other, it would be wonderful. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it starts off as the old – it's somewhere – whether you think of it as satisfying a hungry audience or greed, part of that is just building a franchise and having sequels or spinoffs that you have normally whenever anything is a big hit.
Right.
But in this case, you're protecting this new business entity called All Access, and you're protecting the ego of CBS while they're taking on the old big boys. And now here's Disney going to do the same thing and –
And Star Wars is going to be their big thing on their Disney. Right. It's going to be Star Wars and Marvel. That's going to be their streaming platform's focus.
And people are watching like the Marvel cinema. It also makes me mad that Star Trek was doing this in the 90s before we had fancy words for it. You know, like, oh, look, they've got two series and a movie going. Right. And if they'd had budget, they probably could have done more. But people thought, oh, it's too saturated. And we don't know what saturated is these days.
Right.
But, you know, it rankles me that Star Trek was doing all this 20 years ago, and now it's, the Marvel universe and the cinematic, you know, and there's TV and movies, and they are trying to relate back and forth, and DC is doing it, and blah, blah, blah.
And Star Trek
could get back to doing that.
Star Trek should get back to doing that. Do it now.
Yes. Well, don't you think that CBS saw, you know, Disney, you know, killing it with Marvel and now with Star Wars and thinking like,
oh, yeah.
And the executive's like, we need a franchise that could do that. And we're like, we got Star Trek. And they're like, could we do anything with that? Like,
I don't think it was quite 1977, 78. Like Star Wars hit and they were like, we need a sci-fi. We've got Star Trek. Because they were piddling with it along and just, you know, piddling over a script. But, and they went, no, get this damn thing going now. Put it in production now.
Yeah.
So, they're definitely doing that, and they're definitely – now, and then you guys, there's news that actually Paramount and CBS might – they keep talking about merge, and I want to say either call it a remerge or call it a reconciliation because I've always called it a divorce.
Yeah.
I always talk about the Viacom divorce.
Star Trek and the kids.
Kids, split up. Kids, no, mom and dad are getting back together.
Mama CBS had the kids all these years, and Daddy Paramount got to take the kids on a big trip every two or three years. Mm-hmm. You know,
go to Disney.
but it may not be as easy, you know. And depending on how long the JJ contract goes, and if you're thinking about having a Gene or having a Rick Berman type Ubermeister over all of Star Trek movies and TV, that may be a while till the JJ contract runs its course, or maybe they'll do splash movies. And then they'll do smaller budget Trek movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, maybe since the cinematic prestige is way bigger than the old series was, now that they're on prestige TV and it's cinematic, maybe you don't have to oop the bar that much more for a movie.
Right, right. Well,
are there going to be Game of Thrones movies?
I don't know if that will be a thing, but I did think that,
I know,
like,
they've been talking about a Game of Thrones movie.
It would be cool.
Forever. But.
Well, like I've said this in like forever too, is when Smallville, about, you know, what was
all
that?
30 seasons of Smallville.
All 30 seasons of Smallville has such a huge fan base, and then they should have
cast an unknown as Superman.
They cast an unknown Superman. They should have put that kid from Smallville as Superman, as their new lead as Superman. You would have packed theaters to see that kid play full grown Superman, because he had filled out by that point.
Also, don't put Brian Fuller, the guy who did X-Men, who did that.
Oh, Brian Singer.
Brian Singer. Yeah, Brian. Don't put Brian Singer on it.
But I mean, he was. You know, the kid was in shape. The kid could act. The kid was good looking enough. I mean, it's like, come on, they just squandered. I mean, you built.
You know. Mm-hmm. Oh, go. I'm sorry.
No, I just said they squandered that opportunity. They could have had a huge fan base over Superman. And
one thing that these streaming guys have done, the streaming phenomenon, starting with Game of Thrones. Now, even, you know, you used to talk about The Sopranos. And, well, I said, take it back. Wait. Game of Thrones is on HBO, which technically isn't streaming. I'm sorry. And it started kind of with Sopranos.
A lot of people just stream it,
when it geared up with Game of Thrones, that cinematic peak TV look has broken down a lot of, and the 10, 12, 15 episode short seasons where they blow all this money and they have this huge production value look to things. And Star Trek's and Discovery's doing that for sure.
Right.
And they're nominated for a lot of awards and different things. But that there used to be that huge line between TV actor and movie actor, you know, or TV director, movie director. And you didn't cross that. And you came up and maybe you were, you know, maybe you were Clint Eastwood on Rawhide, and then you get one break and you get one chance to bust out, and then suddenly, bang, you're right. A huge box office draw, and right. You're a movie guy,
yeah.
And you never go back to TV again unless your career's like in a tailspin or something, right?
But that's changed.
And the thing that streaming has done is totally torn that boundary line down after 40 or 50 years, 60 years, and now people go back and forth all the time. And that what you were talking about, your Smallville Superman, that was in the old days. And now if that happened now, maybe you would see that happen.
Well, I'm
saying there wouldn't be so much Hollywood mindset getting in the way of what really ought to happen, what fans would really like to happen.
With DC, it wouldn't happen because DC's got a beautiful television universe and they can't get their movies going right.
I know.
Because they're not using from the TV universe.
Let's not fall into that quagmire. But I mean, could you imagine if Discovery went to like season 2 and then season 3 and they had like a best of both worlds kind of season finale, and it picks up on a movie where this is the resolution, and the movie's way over the top, you know, like, you know, cool effects and, you know, great storyline. That would be fantastic, and that would pack the theaters.
The Gorn War.
Gorn yesterday.
Gorn today. Gorn tomorrow.
But the big leverage thinking would be do that and have that happen, and either like a couple of months later or a couple of months before or something, then launch your second new series on TV streaming.
Yeah.
Yes.
When you do a mini version of, oh, look, the TV cast has run their time and now they're graduating. It's their reward. It's their icing on the cake. You know, like Next Gen going to a movie, and you've still got DS9 and Voyager running on this. I mean, it's a different, slightly different landscape and paradigm and numbers, but it's still kind of the same vibe of they've graduated and they can do guest bits if it fits. But just as far as like leading the audience masses, look over here. Oh, now you're hungry. Now come back over here, and you're piggybacking all that promotion and hoopla,
right.
And absolutely. Start your second season in tandem with your first big movie. I mean, you know, but here's the question. We talked about like finding Discovery only fans. The question I have is now the 15 shows, and we barely talked about things in the weeds. There's all these different aspects of Discovery, the characters, the arcs, what they did, how they wrote it. But to pull back on it in a big way, for one thing, I felt like I was being used a little bit, not overtly, but when all of the internet and all of fandom was into, oh my God, she said enough bomb, you know, and oh my God,
right,
you know, whatever the crisis or the controversy of the week was, 90% of it would be gone in the next episode.
Right.
And that was what the dynamic of, that was really what a short season episodic, these are not episodes, they're just chapters in a book, you know, paradigm was about. And it took everybody, even if you were like braced for it, it took a while to, oh, I see what they're doing to me. You know,
right.
This is what's different. And it took a lot of people, and some people still don't get it. That's why I'm talking about it. And it's not a test. It's not like you passed or not. But what I'm trying to say is now that the controversy of the week is over and we've seen the whole piece, all 15 hours, what is the takeaway from the season?
Yeah.
What's a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what are we going to think? What is Discovery going to mean to people? And, you know, and the people who really were first time fans, you never forget your first.
Yeah.
Even if your first was And the Children Shall Lead, or if your first was,
oh God,
you know, if your first was
the Infinite Vulcan,
if your first was, you know, Code of Honor.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
The first was Threshold.
Oh no.
You've hit upon everything that we cringe on.
So my point is, even if that is your first, you go on and you find, but you still are going to be sent, and I'm usually it's like whole series, right?
Yeah,
but
right.
You still are sentimental and a favorite and attached to that, and you will still, you know, like always defend it, and you will always have a soft place in your heart for that because you never forget your first, right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. So, So people are going to be that way about Discovery. And even if the years go by and things settle in and people go, oh, I wish they could have done that differently. Well, this was happening at the time. There was no way that was going to – wow, it's amazing they went back and kind of retconned that later. But again, overall bottom question is, what do you think – especially the new fans – what do you think is going to make a new fan of Star Trek because of what the total of the first season was? You know, and casting and representation and having first gay couple and all the women and all that stuff. Those are all key things. But as far as like stories and themes and things, I just wonder what people are going to see.
I think there's a couple points that you just hit on there that are important. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we were talking the last episode how they depicted a gay couple. And it was very, you know, like for a straight person myself, I found it, I enjoyed mm-hmm. watching them. It was great. They did a good job. I think having a black female lead, that's wonderful as well. You know, there's a lot of good things that we're seeing in these episodes more inclusive to more people, which is nice. But I still worry that All Access is that barrier and it's not getting people, getting the young people, maybe outside the States in Canada.
Actually, I've heard that Netflix is kind of disappointed with their international Discovery numbers.
Oh, okay, I don't know.
I haven't read anything too specific.
I've heard that from a flaky place that always goes flaky with things.
Okay.
I saw that YouTube. But I wonder if that's actually quoting something that was out legitimately somewhere.
I don't know, because all I've seen is quotes of quotes, like from YouTube comments commenting about it, and from somewhere on Facebook. I remember seeing and Netflix was unhappy. But it's hard to tell how reputable these are. You'd think you'd see it more and more definitive if it was the case, but. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you know, they went, you know, the big overseas markets outside US and Canada, it's the UK, Germany, and Australia are the hugest. It's been that way since the 70s. It's where it's been the longest. It's where there's clubs and support and there's conventions and all that. And the rest of the world, there was a little bit of a catch-up made when the JJ movies came out. I mean, you'd be shocked that like China and Japan aren't bigger Trek, you know, sci-fi, you know, Trek places.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the rest of Europe, maybe. Mm-hmm. I guess since it didn't have Jerry Lewis as a character, France didn't care. I don't know. But, I mean, there's
– Ladies.
There's – I'll cap that. There's a pretty good fandom in Italy. I mean, now it's there a little more. But all the rest of the world is a little weaker compared to Australia, UK. It's all behind that.
Mm-hmm.
North America. And the Kelvin movies did a little bit of that to get people excited, but it's still way behind that. So on one hand, you could say Netflix is maybe disappointed, didn't set the world on fire, but I would have to think they're like in every single damn country, or like 185, big and small.
Right.
And some of them, it was probably 25 cents in a cheap 70s phaser to do the deal.
Right.
But you would have to think that it's really a low bar. So I would think they wouldn't be too upset in most of those countries. I would think it would just be even or above.
Yeah.
You know, like they would, by the time they amortize their cost out. I hear that too, and that maybe they won't be contributing as much. Maybe now CBS has to pony up more proportionally for the budget of two,
mm-hmm.
season
sure.
two versus right. Netflix, and maybe that was the plan all along. So I don't know how much of that they renewed a season two really after two or three weeks of being out.
It was, and they saw the first weeks. Because we were talking about it as it happened, and we were wondering why it hadn't happened sooner. I want to say
it was before the hiatus.
Yeah, it was like halfway through the first half of the series.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter one.
Well, okay, so Discovery, fascinating, and a lot of new fans. But let's talk about something that you've been involved with that me and Dave adore just as much. And it's kind of going back to the older fans, but I hopefully ropes in some new fans as Star Trek Continues. We love Star Trek Continues. It was just such a wonderful, whimsical, just revisit of what we wanted, we wanted to see, you know, and, now that that's over, I mean,
and those last two episodes made me cry and cry and cry, and I just Star Trek Discovery, as much as I've been enjoying it, Star Trek Discovery hasn't hit me.
Yeah, it has not elicited any kind of response.
Like any kind of tearing up.
The Ash Tyler reveal of Vok, we were like, yeah, whatever.
It was telegraphed 5 episodes ago.
He's a shitty boyfriend. What are you going to do?
Did you get to have any involvement in those last 2 episodes? We know you played Bones in the first 2 episodes of the series.
Well, we had like on camera with the big mass audience. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like the audience in the last episode of Enterprise. I specifically wore a gold shirt to be out in the mob of crew.
Cool.
And I was shaved. Oh.
So we wouldn't pick you out normally.
And then everybody within like they overlapped. We CG'd it's like. The group we had live was about a fifth. Like, we basically, like, sat in the first 4 or 5 rows, shot that, and then everybody got up, moved around different places, and then sat in the next 5 rows. And we, like, went all the way back to the back of that. That was a school auditorium in Kingsland.
Nice.
And they had a big – they were doing their spring play or something, and they had their – I want to say it was – I'm trying to remember what it was now. It was really funny. It wasn't Arsenic and Old Lace, but it was some – it wasn't like a – token little dinky high school vanilla play. It was a good play, but they had all the sets on the stage.
That's hilarious.
So, and all we used, for, Vic was green screened into that background, okay. But he stood up on stage. So we all had an eye line that we could all like look to and react. And he did his lines and we would all react to him. But we did the same thing like 5 times and everybody got up, moved around and went increasingly to the back. And Liz Wagner that plays toward the end plays nurse, Burke, mm-hmm. with her little mini version of Yeoman Rand's hair. Right. After about 2 of those, she took it off and just went with her brunette. So even like you wouldn't see 5 of her hairstyle going all the way back.
That'd be funny.
But there's a little shout out to Liz. So everybody, I parted my hair differently and wore gold. And I was like a low. I wanted to be like a lieutenant commander, but I was low. So anyway,
like we can see your sleeves in the back row.
As you do the wave
shirts. It was like what shirts did we have available by the time I got off of my butt and went in and did it.
Yeah,
it was like, well, Larry, we've got left our ensigns or crewmen. Okay, he's an ensign. Okay, no, I was a crewman. No, I wanted to be like a master sergeant, like the highest ranking
chief petty crewman. Officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a CPO. Yeah. Or a senior master sergeant CPO, whatever they would call it. So,
senior field medic.
Yeah. I think in the second batch, I'm like on the very, anyway, we all took tons of pictures and video and stuff. Like everybody was doing that, but it was really, we went and shot that and it wasn't that complicated, but we were there and then we were there at the end of their school day and we were like in their auditorium and all the school kids got out and everybody who was in drama came down. They're like, what are these people in Star Trek uniforms in the way of our set and our stage? It was kind of I guess their teacher hadn't told them or whatever. Yeah.
That's crazy their teacher
like,
didn't
and they
tell
were,
them.
And they were like, are you going to come see our show? Like, well, we're all flying out in 2 days, so no. It's like we're all over the country, so no. But thank you. Good luck. Break leg. It was real cute. But no, the CG work on that was amazing.
Yeah,
so
it was
anyway,
great
you
scene.
Asked me about me. I was always a after Bones, I was creative consultant. I came up with the big fix on Lolani about the 2 generations of Orions.
And really?
It wound up being a Bones line because Vic liked it so much. So I got to say my own thing I just blurted out when we were talking.
Huh.
But everybody thinks about Vena and the Orion slave girl and all that. But then in Enterprise, you find out that the women were really running the society and the men were –
yeah.
Slavers, and the plot of Lolani on Continues was about that she was his property, and they were all freaked about that. Well, the Enterprise people hate us, and I'm like, no, just come up with the fact that they had, like, the women ran things, and then the men ran things, and
it flip flops every couple years, and
of course, I said, but why does anybody have to be a slave to anybody? And Vic said, that's a perfect McCoy line, and so that's what McCoy says. Spock is giving the history, and then McCoy says, why does anyone have to be a slave to anybody? That wound up the dial, which was cool.
That's
but
awesome.
But then even after that, I've got so much video interviews with people and just B-roll video from the stages. Something is going to, you guys praise of continues, and I don't know if this will always be like the little golden era of fan films and we'll never come back to this, or by the time
until
the
CBS releases that tight hold they have on it, fan films are dead.
But part of that is, like, I remember in 96 or 98 when the attorney, not the guys running the original StarTrek.com, but the attorneys, when the internet got big and all the fanboys were putting up their websites, and the way you measured your cojones was how many when frame grabbing was like a new science and you had to have really high tech gear to frame grab off things and, you know, then go in and Photoshop and sharpen things. And it was a big deal. But that's like, if it was your passion hobby, that's what you did. And it was like, well, I've got 5,000 slides on my, you know, images on my site. Well, I've got 47,000 on my slide. Mm-hmm, site. Mm-hmm. And at one point they went in and they did cease and desist letters and told everybody to take down that IP off their websites. They didn't have permission. And everybody at StarTrek.com was going, no, don't do that. Like, we will forever be the big corporate bugaboos. And that's exactly what happened. People like screamed and yelled at big, you know, meanie Paramount beating up on all these little guys in their websites. Nobody was being you know, there might have been one or two commercial people in it, but most of it was
just fans.
But it was the cutting, you know, within 3 or 4 years, the paradigm had totally turned over. That's what everybody did. Anybody with a franchise and IP to protect, you got it that the nature of the internet was sharing, not locking things away in archives the way everything had always been done before.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had things like that when I was doing the Communicator magazine, the official magazine. There were things I wanted to do at one point that we couldn't. We couldn't mention this thing because it wasn't licensed and it wasn't Paramount. But then within 2 or 3 years, that all flip-flopped. But that was the cutting edge of the internet. I mean, the fanboys and girls who were on the cool cutting edge of things are always out there trying to do the newest hot thing. The ones who are on the very back end of that wave are the attorneys who were like, oh, no, wait a minute. Hold on. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to give our rights. We don't want to give, you know, kind of like what you had in the Axanar lawsuit.
Right.
And then within a few years, everybody adjusts and the culture wave catches up to the law and everybody is in a comfort zone. And then it goes on and it's oh, this is what we did 10 years ago. And that's going to happen to fan films.
I eventually. Yeah, I read
By then, we'll be into 4D blue hollow palm emitters or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we'll be just jacked in our head.
Yeah.
I read a book maybe about, I don't know, it was probably over 5 years ago. It's called Brains on Fire. It was about the idea of marketing. And they used to say, basically what you were saying is that they used to have people be like, oh, don't let anybody talk about your product unless they're, you know, officially sponsored. And then they would be like, no, you know, develop these super fans. They are your best ambassador because they love what you do. So they talked about all sorts of examples. Like, one lady was like a scrapbook artist, and she just, that's what she did. They gave her all their material and let her be their ambassador. Mm-hmm. And it was perfect. It's like, and
influencers.
Yes, exactly. So, yes. And that's what happened. So if you get people like Star Trek Continues, let's face it, Star Trek Continues, Axanar, Renegade, all that stuff, that is what put the fire under CBS Discovery.
Exactly what I was saying last year. It's like Star Trek had been off the air for 15 years and there's a drought. And 90% of the reason why all these fan films popped up is because there was no Star Trek.
No Star Trek, and technology had got to the point where you could do it within reason.
And then CBS
You could do a movie on your laptop. Yes.
And then CBS saw us throw all this money at fan films, and they're like, why aren't we getting this? So we got to develop Star Trek now. And then we've also got to stop people from making fan films now because of we want it to come to us now.
I'm going to say this, guys. CBS still had no problem with fan films. Now, the coming of Discovery might have altered this a little bit, mm-hmm. but basically, CBS did not have a problem with fan films. Mm-hmm. CBS had a problem with one fan film.
Yeah, I know.
And going into court for that's where lawyers make you do things.
Sure, but the rules make it feel like...
If you're
going
to win this, then you have to come out here and be a hard ass and put this out there.
Right.
But that's the thing, is the rules make it feel like they're against all fan films, because like you can't do more than two, and they have to be 15 minutes apiece.
I'm going to say...
It's like anti-consumer and anti-fan.
I was on defending the Axanar boat for a long time, and then I started realizing that there were issues other than that. And it's like having kids. When your kids, you allow them to do so mm-hmm. much, and then all of a sudden they just go too far. You're like, whoa, you're going too mm-hmm. far with this, and we got to pump the brakes here. Where, I mean, it seemed to me that Star Trek Continues, you guys had a wonderful relationship with them. So
absolutely.
I will say again, everybody had a wonderful... If you were big... Most of the little mom-and-pop fan films mm-hmm. aren't a problem.
Yeah, right,
if you
right.
were big enough to be on CBS's radar,
yeah.
everybody got along with CBS. Like, they asked us... Even when we were releasing our last episodes, they and it started bumping into... You know, Discovery went from nothing to this delay, and then, okay, now we're doing September, bang, we have dates. Mm-hmm. They ask us to jiggle some of our premiere dates just so we wouldn't overlap some of the yeah. Sunday night episodes.
Right. Right.
Like, even at that point, or, you know, if something about a font or something, if it went along and they wanted us to do something, we would. And there was a time when there were a couple of robot takedowns on YouTube.
Mm.
And some of the, you know, the blather online was that, oh, they went over the line somewhere. It's like, no, it was a algorithm took us down. Mm-hmm. We actually got we would make a discreet call and get some help from CBS to just accelerating what was going to happen anyway.
Right.
Didn't go out of their way except to just make a call and say, you know, don't have this take a month. Just. We had nothing to do with this.
Right, right.
And letting
right.
us know. So, but that was the way it was with everybody. Everybody had that relationship except for
yeah.
one entity.
Yeah, the one entity. Yeah. And let's not get too far into that. But I mean.
Right. I don't want to, but I'm just saying.
Yeah,
I just say that. Everybody likes to broad brush this for comfort zone. It's like, and that's why. And so they worked with everybody. They were going to end. When they did their guidelines, they did want the way fan films had been up until then had to end. Mm-hmm. But they did let everybody basically land their own planes on their own time, unless they saw, like, Tommy Kraft, and they said, don't start a new thing up from, like, mm-hmm. you know. But, mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
Continuous had already done its crowdfunding, and we had made the commitments and promises, and so they let us basically, you
fulfill
know.
Fulfill those. Yeah.
Fulfill those, right, right.
Yeah, it's cool. But, again, Continues... Star Trek Continues.
But apart from all that.
All yeah. that. But Star Trek Continues, I mean, what a piece of work of just, I
and
mean,
love.
Love and like I said, revisiting that time of, and capturing it, like really capturing it without overstepping it and without underdeveloped. It was just perfect. It was a perfect balance. And you guys just
nailed it.
Well, yeah. It was a great. You know, thanks to Vic and everybody, he got to come aboard. And after it got going, it was easy. You could point to the resume and go, here, this is what we do. You want to be part of this? Oh, my God, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was – but the bottom line was – and a lot of people had done different takes on that era and all that. But everybody – what made that different also was the fact that it was historical recreation.
Mm-hmm.
People say, oh, we're going to do the fourth season of original series, or we want to do it like 19. No, like, no, we're really going to do it. And just because we could do something better now, mm-hmm. we could be splashier or something. It's like, no, would this have looked – and there were times when we pushed this ourselves. But it's like, would this have fit – is there halfway this seems like it's 1970, like mm-hmm. the next year, or 1971? No, don't just do something cool because you can. If you want to, that's fine. But don't say this is what you're doing. Right. If you want to do something of your own, then go over here and do it. And it'll have it look like In a Mirror Darkly on Enterprise
right,
or
right.
something, you
right,
know.
Right.
And yeah. that's what – and then you get into like what Discovery could have done. And my soapbox there is design versus cinematography. And you could have had both mm-hmm. instead of having to make choices. That whole you can't make it like 1964. No one in 2017 is going to watch it. It's like you could really have both. You could yeah. make both happy, but it all is on how you assign the project and how you the way you approach it. And we'll you can let creatives be creative.
I think we'll see in season two how close they can walk yeah. that line.
I just think they're just it's a visual reboot. That's all we're talking. And I not that I mean I'm a huge original series fan, but I mean, to get younger people in, you can't go back to that. I mean, you can touch on it. You can keep on the same feel to it. But I think Discovery is a visual reboot. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, you're changing it up a little bit. Simple as that. Larry looks like, skeptical.
No, not skeptical. It's like I can come in here and say my piece, and I can bridge the gap and say my piece. It's like, but do I really want to go there? It's like, do I really want to go into? I don't want to take another 30 minutes on it. No, that's what I was just saying. Is I really think. I think just like in a lot of life these days, we get all into one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot – and not for a wishy-washy vanilla milquetoast compromise. But I really think there's times when we are told we have to choose between two things. Mm-hmm. And we could really have them both, or we could have like 80% of both.
Right.
Or I just think sometimes if we just come at everything – if we just come at something from like a little different angle, mm-hmm. we would be surprised. I just think we fall into some of these ruts of thinking, and I'm saying this has been apparently about a whole fan community now, but I really thought that I said Inner Mirror Darkly. I really thought Inner Mirror Darkly, and that's 2005 storytelling and drama, cinematography for TV. Yeah. That's not what we're doing here. This is two or three steps beyond that. But I really thought that even then it showed the viability of those 1964 designs mm-hmm. built with modern materials and tweaks and, you know, a lot of things done, not exactly the same way as 60, but the lines, if the lines of design were built that way and with modern materials. But the big thing was you don't shoot it like 1964, you shoot it like 2005 or 2017. And good. You frame it, you light it, you good put point. Lenses, you edit it
right.
for now.
I mean, and we saw it. We saw it in Relics. We saw it in Tribbles and Tribulations.
Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah, I mean,
well, Tribbles had to match the film. I mean, that wasn't totally the same because they had to match. They had to go in and out of the film.
But I mean, they did it, like without. They did it without, you know, pulling any punches. They showed those sets.
Yeah,
and
funny.
But I mean, we saw the Enterprise, and it's Pike's ship, but it's we're only talking. You know, 10 years or whatever it is,
like 8 years
before mm-hmm. before Kirk, and it's a different ship. Yeah. You know, there's no getting around it.
Well, I think it's more like a perfect bridge between the TOS ship and the TNP ship, because there's no way you could refit the TOS ship into the TNP ship without replacing every single part. And I feel like Discovery just gave us something right in the middle, so it makes sense that you could refit that ship into the TNP ship,
but. In between, you have TOS, so...
That's what I'm saying.
No, you're saying you're going back and revisiting the whole 2269 to 2271. How did this one... How did Enterprise Incident or Turnabout Intruder become motion picture ship in 2 years or 2.5 years?
Yeah, or whatever it was.
If that was really... Well, I mean, like the last time you saw it in original series, here's what it looked like. Now you're expected to believe that the ship totally was changed, and you're saying it had to be from the ground up. Well, that's what we've... For 40 years, we've lived with the thing of whatever it took, that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's not the same ship anymore, which is why I like the design of the Discovery one, because it's kind of a middle ground, but from what we used to see in the original series and then the TNP movies. It's a nice middle ground, and so I can see the progression of that ship turning into the TNP ship. I can't see it from 1966 Enterprise to the 1979 or whatever it is, a motion picture.
Yeah.
To me, that doesn't make sense. There's no bridge for you can change this part. It's just like everything's different. Mm-hmm. But with the new one, it's like, well, I can see the part. You only have to change a couple parts.
I mean, honestly, the ship was nice. I had no problem with the ship. It was obviously they had changed it, and it's not like it's not horrible. You know, I can live with it. I can roll with the punches. I do wonder who is playing Spock, who is going to play Pike. You know, I mean,
number one.
It's going to be interesting to see who they're casting for these things. So,
oh, that's the least of my worries. I want to know about that. See, this is interesting. This whole last few months, ever since those 5 seconds were on there, I had been braced by people that worked on the show. That there'd be an Enterprise, and then right close to that they wouldn't go aboard. It would just be outside. It would be a cool moment. And then right before the actual dropping of the show, had been braced for the worst. as far as the look. Like, oh, my God, it's going to be so. And then when I did see it, I went, well, that's not. In fact, all those early it's only that side and below angle that you really – you see the lip on – you see the apron at the hangar deck. You see the waffle grid on the side of the secondary hull, and you see it, you know, that the pylon's a little more. But those early approach shots are all very murky and generic, and you go, oh, my God. And you were there, and it's only that last shot that then got freeze framed and everybody saw it that people were like, yeah. But this whole thing has made me realize that all these years, all the assumptions that people are, you know, like a lot of hardcore fans and diehard fans and fans I've parted with for billions of years and written with and worked with, and veterans, you know, Hollywood people who are fans, and what you just said kind of brought that out, that there have always been a lot of people have carried different camps of assumptions around. We just didn't, it never came up, and it took something like this to bring it out, which is, in my head, we were told that the ship went from this at the end of the series to this at the movie, and however they did it, by God, I mean, they tell me that the ship goes in warp drive in a subspace bubble, and you know, so in the same token, now there's plenty of things I laugh about. You know, I go, oh, okay, and someday we'll figure that out. But even Klingon forehead, people would laugh about, people would want to know what it was. People laughed about the people who wanted to know the difference. But by God, it took the fanboys on the last year of Enterprise, and they joked about it in Tribulations and made it worse.
Yeah, right.
I mean, Ron and Renee said, we wanted to say something, we couldn't agree what to do, so we just made it a joke. Well, by making it a joke, it acknowledged it. So not, it made it even more real.
Yeah, yeah. It's more acute. Yeah.
Right. And it took another 10 years before they came up with, and it was convoluted. But like I say, texture, not trivia. It was a thing. So to me, however it happened, that ship was that way one, and 2 years later, it was that one. So that's where I come from. But to make this whole debate really kind of got me, and it made me stand back. And what I finally came down to was, I think of Star Trek as a, and even though there's like illogic loops in there, and we have to, and like obvious things that are said two different ways or shown two different ways, and we just have to say, okay, go with the second one because that's what it evolved into. You know, like not use SPA, the Federation of Planets, or Starfleet, right? Or whatever.
Right.
All those little things, like, especially in the early years of any of the shows, and then things would like get tweaked and made better, whatever. But basically, this is what it is, and that's the strength of Star Trek, and that's why Star Trek is not like any other. Oh, it's Spider-Man and Batman, and we'll reboot every 4 years. It's Star Trek never did that until now.
Yeah, right.
They always found a reason to explain the changes.
Right.
And if you got that, then – and a lot of people like ridiculed this, but what dawned on me finally was this whole debate about touchscreens or video hologram viewers or the shape of the old Enterprise or whatever. If you were doing a World War II movie or a Civil War movie or whatever in 1950, it would not look the same as it did in 1960 or 1970. Or I mean, every era
has a new look.
Ancient Rome. Yeah, the movies all look differently. But hopefully you don't change the shape of the German helmet, you know?
Sure.
Or right. You don't change the shape of the Union, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, or the Panzer.
Yeah, so that's that kind of crystal. Yeah, the Panzer tank. Or the Sherman tank. And to me, that's what crystallized it. It's like you're going to shoot it a different way because it's the time you're in. And of course, you're playing to that audience. But you don't play with the design lines.
So
and
you,
I said that.
Yeah,
and then I had people go, I don't care. This is fiction. It's future fiction. It's not history.
Right.
So we don't have to. And I go, well, then if that's your attitude, you're fine to think that. But then Star Trek will not be Star Trek if that is where you go.
It's an interesting argument.
Because then it'll still be. And people go, Star Trek's about the stories and being hopeful and optimistic and giving people inspiration. I go, yes, it is. Yes, it is. But that's one of the factors. One of the factors was this other.
Yeah,
and my whole point was, if you take that away, then Star Trek will be just another awesome storytelling vehicle. It won't be the one that's got this unique thing that puts it beyond even everybody else that's popular, right? Even beyond Star Wars.
Right. We were having this argument last episode,
but I'm trying not to argue.
It's
a discussion.
It's a discussion. I'm not arguing.
I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the world.
Yeah.
Because my point is, like, if that's what you want, then okay. But just bear in mind, that's what we're talking. I just tried to pull back and put a scope on it and say, here's all the unassumed things we've gone along with.
Right.
But let's step back another step and go, here's what we're really talking
right,
about. And
right.
for a lot of people, this is why it's important. And I'm not going to jump off a cliff. I'm not going to damn the show. I'm going to support to the end. But I'm saying if you do this, then you're taking away one layer of the specialness of Trek. And even though that may not have been what attracted some people to it, mm-hmm. that's in the big picture. That's what's always been amazing about Star Trek. And if it goes away, then that will be a sad day. And maybe the realists will come up and say, you didn't really expect to keep this up for another couple of hundred years, did you?
It was interesting.
And if you say, yeah. no, maybe not. And maybe 50 years was a good run.
Right.
Maybe well, it's just out, you know, we're all human beings. But well, I'm saying I didn't think that had to happen.
Samuel said the one thing is like, well, if you kept a car from the 1950s or 60s and you kept it in pristine condition and, you know, you know, made sure it looked beautiful all the time. And then you gave it to some young kid, get in the car and he, you know, dragged it into a ditch somewhere and smashed it up. I mean, you lost something there. That's something beautiful that should have preserved. And I thought that's an excellent argument. Now, like I said, I'm willing to roll with this as much as possible.
Yeah.
But
I said the same thing.
Me too. Yeah.
But he makes an excellent point that what's to be said about those people who preserved that for all those years, that beautiful, like, you know, Bel Air or whatever, you know, that was there forever. And it was a gorgeous car. And then you gave it to that young 20-year-old and, you know, he or she just smashed it into the ditch and wrapped it around a tree or whatever. So,
and that's even treating it like a relic.
Not a relic, but
I'm talking about having it always be eternally new and fresh.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not just, oh, look, we've got this seminal thing that we all treasure because it's a museum piece. I'm talking about something that found its way to a new audience.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know.
Well, I mean,
Trials and Tribulations was cool because they married that. They went to the trouble to do all that to marry 30-year-old film into their look and but then they made fun well, they didn't make fun of it, they would laugh about it, but also say it was, you know, Dax's cool line about the black lines, and I think Bashir and O'Brien make fun of some of the stuff, but yeah. The point was it was real to them.
I mean the Enterprise is in the Air and Space Museum. It's in the Smithsonian, so it's
right. Yeah,
I mean it's that important.
Parts of it were sent here to Buffalo to be restored.
Wonderful.
Oh, cool.
But I mean that being said, it's like it's that important. It's that mm-hmm. It's that seminal of a, you know, of an icon, and why would
it has
you,
that much impact and emotional resonance.
Oh, I know. And yeah. It does bear the weight of why did you feel the need to change it? So,
yeah.
And inspire. And the point, you know, they'll say, there are people that will say, why do you have a fictitious, you know, spaceship from a movie in this hall that honors real people, mm-hmm. like real flight and real space travel? And they say, because that inspired,
yeah.
you know, the mutual NASA Star Trek love affair. And not Star Wars, that was the other thing about, you know, Star Trek was from us. So yes. The people that say, get off your high horse about the design and discovery, because no, it's not you can't have historical, it can't be a period piece. It can't be historical, you know, research on it, because it hasn't really happened and it's in the future.
Sure.
I would say, yes, it has. There are tons of – there's reference. You can have tons of people tell you exactly what something was. They might quibble over details, but then they quibble over the details of something from ancient Rome or the Civil War too, mm-hmm, still. Mm-hmm. But yeah. You've got real reference to go to. So in a way, it is. And if it means that much that it's in the Smithsonian, then you should treat it like it's historical reality that you can reference and yeah. do right,
absolutely,
wrong.
Or absolutely.
I mean, do you feel that Discovery stepped on a lot of maybe not on air canon, but a lot of, you know, canon that's been already established? You know,
Whom God Destroys, the one that sticks out to me.
Yeah, that's sticks in our craw.
Which one?
Whom God Destroys, when Kirk says that he studied Garth of Isengard,
his tactics during
the Klingon War, and he would only be at least a cadet, if not an ensign. But at this point, he'd be a lieutenant.
On the Farragut.
So it doesn't really line up chronologically. So that's
– well, see, you're talking to a guy here that thought – the Axanar fan film, and I told Alec this at the beginning, apart from everything else later, I'm talking about just the core idea of Axanar, the Klingon, the 4 years war, that came out of the Fasa Fasa, however you say it.
Yeah, game the Fasa game.
It was never film. To me, film canon, and this is like old boy fandom from the beginning, I always thought, and I thought, because that's where the clues, it's like CSI, I just go where the clues go. And I always thought the clues were that there was never a sustained hot war between the Federation and Klingons. And that's why, and I know in Tribbles they say there was the Battle of Danadu 5 inconclusive. I basically saw it like a corollary to the Soviet Union and USA, that there may have been proxy wars, and that's what
Aaron Immersi.
Private
Little War.
Yeah, Private Little War. That's what Private Little War was about. But Errand of Mercy, I thought the drama of Errand of Mercy was that they really were thinking – I thought it was like the Cuban Missile Crisis. I thought they were thinking, oh, my God, we actually might be shooting at each other face-to-face.
Right.
So I thought the power of Errand of Mercy was that even though they'd had these skirmishes and this Cold War going on forever – and, of course, it was the first time you met a Klingon, so – we were getting it off for the first time. But over the years, McCoy says there's been 70 years of unremitting hostility. Well, that doesn't mean there's been a 70-year-long hot war.
Sure.
So that means that they've been
– on and off.
Cheek by jowl, they used to say, that they've always been, you know, banging heads but never shot at each other. So the whole idea of – but then again, what was Axanar? I always thought Axanar was something about the interior of the Federation. And he says, well, because of – your battle victory and that
is actually a very excellent point.
Mr. Spock and I can be brothers. What would a Klingon war have to do with Kirk and Spock being brothers or not? See, I always thought it was an internal thing that threatened the fabric of whether it was specifically Vulcan or it was something that there was I felt like it was a whiskey rebellion for the Federation or something. It was like something threatened the internal fabric after 100 years, and they put it down, and it just happened to have happened at Axanar. And you know, and then they actually showed an Axanarian in Enterprise, and it kind of took some of the mystique away that there was a planet and it was close in, and they went by there, and you know, so I just always thought it was something about
that. Actually, Larry, you just gave me a totally different perspective of thinking that maybe Axanar did happen before, and it was just like you said, a flare up, a localized, you know, from that solar system or what have you, of a conflict between the Klingons and the Federation, and they just, you know, it was something that was spectacular, but it was, you know, it came and went. Or I mean, who knows? I mean, we don't know that story fully, but it's a possibility, and I mean, that would happen. Maybe 15 years before Kirk, so I don't know exactly the time frame, but I mean, when he was in the Academy, so.
I mean, it had to have been history long enough to be in the history books, but I mean, like in a modern day, I mean, it's immediately on social media or on the news or something, so he could have studied it then. But, you know, before we start wrapping up, I did want to check with Larry about the Khan of Wrath.
Oh, the Khan of – well, let's see. We talked about – so the Trek Files has been a huge thing that came up like last summer. And I was, you know, Rod asked me about doing our podcast now that we're talking about with the document and the 15 minute every week. And that was amazing. And we pre-recorded a bunch of those. So we've got about 15, 16 in the can. And only having them be 15 minutes, I can have a guest come on and do, you know, three or four of them. So
that's nice.
But that took some time last fall. We got all ready for that to launch. And then we had Discovery, all the hoopla around Discovery coming out and, you know, paying attention to that. And the summer con season last year, I'm saying all this to say that the Khan of Wrath has kind of had a backseat. I urgently need to get back on, put it on front burner and get on with – because we've shot 90% of what we need to do. I just had a woman though. I was just at at Gallifrey One, the WhoCon here in Los Angeles, and a woman came up to me and said, I saw you talking about the Khan of Wrath online, and I – want to talk to you about that. I was there. I mean, people are still coming out of the woodwork that were actual survivors.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of things. But we need to get on with wrapping it up. And I know I've been saying that for a year. It's just that Star Trek world, real Trek land kind of exploded again.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
Yeah.
On me. We started this in the fallow times as something to do in the fallow years. But I do need to wrap it up. So if people want to – I still have a webpage up there. I have an old school, not – a Kickstarter type thing or a GoFundMe, but I have like my own perks there if you want to help out. If you're hearing this and you want to be like associate producer level or above and make a major impact on it, get a hold of me too, because that's where I am right now. But yeah, we're trying to wrap it up and get it going as soon as we can and get it out. I'm out of excuses. It just aside from the rest of the world kind of blew up.
I will give you that this last year has been quite crazy with Star Trek. It's, I mean, who would have known that this would have been this big?
In a good way.
Oh yeah, in a very good way.
Been wanting for a long time, but
right. Yeah.
And it followed right, you know, from the 50th anniversary hoopla right into all of this.
It did
too,
just fall right into it. Yeah, and it's been a crazy 2 years actually.
Yeah,
yep.
Lots gone on.
We had Beyond, and then we had Discovery. So I mean, that's a lot of news
and continue. And then we were just talking about Axanar, just touching. I mean, there was all that. I mean, there was a lot going on. That there was
a lot of Star Trek in the news.
Yeah, we were like our heads were spinning for a while. So you know, and you know, it's just hopefully it'll continue.
There'll be the drip coming out. I'm sure there'll be a way for everybody to CBS All Access to tease the drips coming out of the writer's room. And when they start shooting again, if they let Ted and some of the producers do their social media little photo leaks that they love to do. But there'll be that. But it's really going to go back to being a fallow time again, unless
Tarantino
Trek.
Well, I mean, the shooting for Discovery Season 2 starts in April, so we should start getting at least tidbits and casting news
soon. That's what I'm
saying.
Yeah. I mean, we're downshifting a little bit here, but it'll also be SummerCon season, and we'll see. It won't be exactly the same as it was before, because now the known is out there, so all the, you know, the main cast and who lived. But it'll just be the question of what they're going to do and what this group will look like when they get to start with a blank slate and all that. But my point is, there's been a little bit of the foam is off a little bit here, so we should get on and we should get on with things and get on. See, I have another project that I want to start after the Trek Files started that I've been talking about doing with Roddenberry, and slightly different, but not a podcast, but another kind of show. And that's in my head too, but we really need to get the Connor Rath wrapped up because it's an awesome show, and
I'm so excited to see it all put together, because you know, you kind of got me in some of the transcribing that was needed for the thing, and it was so fascinating, just these people's views and the stuff that happened. So
tell me real quick, because there's no way I remember, because I had like a lot of people's. Did you see an attendee? Did you see a dealer? Did you see an organizer?
Mine was a dealer. And that was so incredibly fascinating. I know, I mean, it was almost an hour long by itself. And so I know not much of that will end up in the final thing. But just that one person was so interesting. I can't wait to see all these other people's point of view and perspective. And Bonnie Moss, since we've had her on the show before, I can't wait to hear from her as well in the Con of Wrath. So I'm just super excited to see how this is going to come together.
Well, thanks. I am too.
That's really cool stuff. Yeah.
And where we end up with it, yeah. So all of that, and then the other thing was I've been really trying to build up Portal 47 here. I'm into the third year of that, and we keep having new deep divers come aboard. So the way I talk with things about you guys, the new and the old both, it's a lot about me, but it's really a lot about just trying to – all the Star Trek that I know is out there. I keep saying it's for all the people who have no idea how much Star Trek they have no idea about. Whether it's in the 60s or the 80s, 90s, aughts. And eventually, today, we're still in the dicey area of people being able to talk freely. But getting the voices out and getting all the people that – there's so much – I mean, we've had people from the original series on our guest night, you know. Mm-hmm. But awesome. What's weird is I had – because the Portales all have the 47ers. We have a Facebook page just for us and then past guests. And last year when things were getting really weird online and there was a lot of trolling going on with Discovery and like even people that wanted to critique Discovery couldn't do it in peace because somebody would come in and make it worse or whatever.
They just shit all over everything, yeah.
And I'd have people say – some of our members would say, thank you for having our page where I can come and we can talk about these things
without
and we
it.
Can go there without being, you know, kamikazed and trolled and bombarded.
Isn't it a weird
safe
environment?
Space.
It's a very, like, very really? Weird environment that we where we're in at this point where, you know, like you know, me and Dave,
the pseudo anonymity makes people just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, me and Dave talk about, like we said, good and bad about Discovery. But once if we say something a little bad, people go like, "Oh, you just hate Discovery." No, we don't hate Discovery. Or people will be like, "Oh, you guys just praise Discovery." Like, no, mm-hmm. we don't. So it's really weird. It's like it's a hot and cold.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people they're black and white. They're either hot or cold. And I hate to say this, but I don't want to get political or anything, but I think eventually we're going to find out not just politics, but there's been a lot of dissension showed online by a lot of well-meaning people had been taken advantage of because mm-hmm. we had no idea it was going to happen, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. how a lot of our social media has been manipulated by the bots and trolls
you know,
offshore.
Larry,
even on things that have nothing to do with politics.
Yes, Larry, yeah. I was saying the same thing maybe a month ago or 3 weeks ago. I said something like, I think there's a lot of, like, I don't know if they're Russian bots or they're just, like, people sowing discord in the Star Trek community. It's bizarre. I can't quite figure out what the freak is going on. It's like most people –
I think it's anything that gets people upset and divided where
yeah.
normally we could – or even if we had different opinions, we would just talk. But anything that, like, ramps up the walls to where
yeah.
people are just walled off and it just kind of fractures the culture.
Yeah.
Not to where we don't all agree the same, then we'd be robots, but where we can't even just like talk about it.
Yeah. I mean,
right?
I mean, there's certain scenes in every, you know, movie or show that we're like, yeah, I liked it or Dave didn't like it or, you know, Dave liked it, I didn't like it.
Right,
I mean, it happens, but.
And it's always been that way.
And we can have an honest disagreement about it, but these people like, they just attack you and go for the jugular. It's weird.
Crazy people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the first thing I do, if I see somebody that comes in and there's like a thread going, even like on Facebook, and it's mostly people I know,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of people I don't know, but they found their way to a good old-fashioned Star Trek page, and I may not know everybody directly, but you can kind of tell the vibe of the way people are talking. And, you know, it's one thing about the Comic-Con era has been interesting because the franchises mixed there where they didn't used to, like, at all Trek cons, right?
Right.
And I talk to a lot of actors and actors' handlers and agents and all that, and they always talk about, of all the franchises, and whether they're comic or sci-fi or anime or, you know, where they come from, that Star Trek fandom is, like, the nicest, quote-unquote.
Hmm.
Even though we think that's crazy because we've seen arguments yeah. over the years break
visceral
out.
Visceral arguments.
Well, but as far as like people in a building,
yeah.
it's like if you tell Trek, you ask Trek fans to do something over here, they all go and do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
And,
I think that speaks to Star Trek's message.
See something, yeah, and when the last couple of years, when you see weirdness online, that's where you go. You know, the first reaction from a lot of people is like, I'm sorry, do you not know this franchise?
Yeah,
or,
it's like,
do you not
yeah.
know what this is about or where have you been?
Right, right.
But, you know, the bottom line, whatever you're in, sports or politics or fandom or whatever, or sci-fi, I mean, go and click on that person. No, go look at their numbers and their bio and see,
yeah, right.
you know, if they have 12 friends and 6 posts. Then
right.
you go,
oh
well, he probably is a.
Yeah, it's just somebody else.
Crazy person.
Yeah.
Well, where can we find all of your stuff online, Larry? Go ahead and give us let us know.
Yeah. LarryNemechek.com is always my basic there. You can get to I need to add Trek Files. The Trek Files is all at Facebook. So if you're just on Facebook and go to The Trek Files, you can get the weekly episode. You can get the documents. That's the other thing. Anything we talk about, one page or 15 pages – it's there every week. It comes out on Tuesdays.
Nice.
Tuesdays at 12:01 a.m.
Hmm.
So the Europeans get it first, and then it's here for the night owls or whatever. But and then it's up for a week, and it's all still there. But you can see, if you subscribe, you can go to podcast.roddenberry.com because it is a Roddenberry podcast. And thank you again, Rod.
Hmm.
And you can subscribe. There's a couple of – I think Stitcher is one that we're still working on. But
You're on iTunes. I've subscribed to you on iTunes.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
It's on iTunes. And the commentary tracks are there. I mean, people posted the 1986 thing, as I knew would happen, made a big splash all over the place and got us a lot of eyeballs. So they're not always going to be that groundbreaking, but hopefully between the guest and the letter and sometimes the most innocuous – things get you talking. That's the whole point of this, is just to bring a new light to Gene, a new light, whether it was to him or from him, what we're talking about, and then new light on that era. And we're going to have things from the 70s and the 80s, too. So the whole 70s, what will the next movie be, you know, frustration of a return decade, and the 80s. We get into those things, too. But it's about Gene and the times and the media and what it means for us today. So we even had one where I fell off my chair. There was a line that was a direct quote out of Discovery's pilot, but it was from a memo going into Next Generation. And I was like, wow, this is suddenly relevant here in a big way. So I hope everybody, wherever they're coming from, will find something fresh, either something newsworthy or at least a cool insight, which is, you know, what I all through Trekland, Portal 47 and my little thing weekly on Facebook, at my Facebook page at Larry Nemechek's Trekland at 1 o'clock Pacific, Trekland Tuesdays live. I try to find, like we've been talking here, I try to take a step back maybe and let the rest of the internet go on its merry way with what the hot thing is at the moment, and not that I will shy away from it, but I think if we step back and look at a bigger picture, we may see things, especially when we have fans from all so many different eras who may not even be connected into each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yeah. And I do think there's a rich history of Trek that we can constantly look back into.
Absolutely.
Well, I think there's a lot of Trek that we still, I mean, I love finding new things still. And Dorothy Fontana on our last episode of Trek Files was telling me something about Number One's character that I had no idea. It was in their minds. Mm-hmm. It never got on script or on memo or on much less on film.
Hmm.
And of course it was a one-off.
Cool.
And she was talking about some of the things they had in their heads about Number One that if they'd gone to series, they would have tried to play with.
Nice.
Which was just – so, yeah, go back and listen. It's only 15 minutes, folks. Go back and
– for sure. Yeah,
Everyone should check that out for sure. Check out
– Portal 47. You get to my page, but portal47.net. It's a subscription for a year, and then you go on month to month, and we have all different – there's 9 points every month, and online, live, and then live things – at conventions. I hope everybody – it's a whole new paradigm. It's hard to explain. So, you know, go read about it.
Yeah.
And then at Larry Nemechek on Twitter.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Well, the show, you can find it at Syntholics.com. You can email us at Syntholics@yahoo.com. On Twitter, we're at Syntholic Duo. Personally, I'm David_J_Duncan.
I'm Blackbird2004. And if you can, please go to Apple iTunes, rate and review us, 5 stars preferably, and maybe give us a nice little comment. And if you got a little money, please throw it our way to help grease the wheels of podcasting. Go to Patreon.com/Syntholic and throw us a little coin our way if you can.
That would help us out so much. And the reviews are super helpful on iTunes to help us get found in the algorithm, because that always helps. And you can always go door-to-door like the Mormons, because that always works.
That works, too, if you want to do that for our podcast. We'd love that. If you if you do know your aunt, your uncle, your best friend, your workmate, if they know that they listen to podcasts, definitely let us know about our podcast.
Let us know, too.
Yeah, do that. Word of mouth is a wonderful way to support the show for free. It's great to let people know about the podcast existing. And Dave also has been working very hard, fiercely, typing his fingers to the bone, working on YouTube, getting our YouTube channel up.
Oh, thanks, Larry.
Excellent.
You liked my Canard video that I put up on Camp Kittimer.
Yes,
I saw you like that. That was good. So I do a weekly cocktail video, and I've been doing a Star Trek Discovery review. And then once Discovery's done, we're a couple episodes behind. Once that's done, I got to figure out something new.
Our yodeling sessions will go into
your yodeling. Yeah. Just as long as you don't do like a yodeling conspiracy YouTube series.
That just sparked my imagination.
I'll have to get you on for yodeling conspiracy, Larry.
Well, I can think of a few other conspiracy show topics that I might be better at than yodeling.
They yodeled the wrong way, don't you know?
Who really killed Green Acres? No, I'm kidding.
That'd be great.
But Larry, as always, it's so wonderful to have you on our show, and you are just I can't believe the stuff you know and the stuff that you can, you know, information you can just tell us. As you know, as you do.
Well, that's what I said. I enjoy sharing and that, but I really have been trying to keep a blinders open to I think we get into our ruts and that undercurrent. It's easy to look backwards and see where things happen. But like I go to a con now and I get and it hits me in the face every time. I'll do this show of hands and there's nobody there that says they came to Trek from the JJ movies or now Discovery. And there's a reason for that. It's like they tend to be younger. They may not have the money to get to a convention, even if it's like in their own town. And I'm just gotten really attuned to I want to hear them because we're not, you know, in 5 or 10 years they'll be out there.
Right.
But I want to know now.
Right. Well, if you are a fresh Discovery watcher or JJ, maybe got in JJ,
let us know. We'd love to reach out to you and talk with you.
And we'll have Larry's info on the show notes. Definitely hit him up. Let him know. Hey, yeah. I came on, you know, watching Star Trek, the 2009 reboot. You know,
like I said, and guys, I'll tweet me at Larry Nemechek, and you know, just hit me up online. I'm reading my feed all the time.
And
so.
I'm sure you would like to have a discussion, like what got you into that. So
yeah, same here. Yeah. Tweet us as well. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you again, Larry, for joining us. It was so much fun.
Thank you guys. Thank you guys. It was a good, out of the ordinary, at least the way it looks online sometimes, conversation.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, live long and prosper, one and all. Thanks, everybody.
Trek well.
Trek well. And we'll bullshit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had.